Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what is reputational security for states? And what exactly do public officials do to protect their states' reputations? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. States act according to their interests. This is the most basic observation of my field of studies, international relations. We presume this interest is power and or security, but how states advance their power and their security is actually quite wide and varied. We speak of issues like soft power, as opposed to just military power or economic power, the importance of being attractive, the importance of being respected. And on today's show, our guest explores in a new book, the concept of reputational security. The book's entitled Reputational Security, Refocusing Public Diplomacy for a Dangerous World. The author is Nicholas J. Call. He's professor of communication at the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California. And yes, one of my colleagues at USC. He's the author of The Decline and Fall of the United States Information Agency, American Public Diplomacy from 1989 to 2001, Public Diplomacy, Foundations for a Global Engagement in the Digital Era, and in this context, as a historian of public diplomacy, we'll examine his new book on reputational security. Nick Call, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
So I guess the first question broadly is, what's the purpose of the book, especially considering that concepts like soft power and public diplomacy have been well established, including by you and a number of other scholars? Mm-hmm. What makes reputational security different?
Well, this book is really born out of a mismatch that around 2017, I did a number of trips overseas to countries whose foreign policy was in difficulty, countries that felt endangered. And I realized that when I was talking to people in government in those places, to diplomats and people in their foreign ministries, soft power really didn't describe what they were experiencing. The thing with soft power is that it fits the experience of the United States in the first instance. It was always applied and measured with a view to the most successful countries, and was a concept that the most successful country might pursue to be just a little bit more successful. But when I was talking to officials in Kosovo and in Kazakhstan and in Ukraine, I got a very different sense. For them, it wasn't about gaining a reputation or enhancing a reputation so that you could get just a little bit more in the world. It was about having a reputation in the first place so something really awful didn't happen to you. So they had a whole idea that being known could give them an edge in the event of a crisis. And in Ukraine, it seemed clear that part of the explanation for why the country hadn't been supported in 2014 was that people didn't know their story. And the more I looked into this, there really seemed to be something in it, that if you think back to 2014, we didn't even know how Ukrainians pronounce the names of their cities. There wasn't yet a consensus on the name of the country. Many writers still routinely referred to it as the Ukraine, using transferring the Russian language terminology rather than thinking of it as a place in its own right. And I think that this uncertainty over Ukraine meant that there was something missing in the international response. Flash forward to 2022, and it seems clear that having a reputation, being known, having your narrative known, makes a difference. And when Ukraine was violated in 2022, the reaction from the world was different. So this got me thinking that there was such a thing as reputational security, that you can tell when a country doesn't have it, and when a country does have it, a crisis goes a little bit better than it would otherwise. So that's the main reason for writing the book. But once I got into it, I started thinking about the neglected dimension of soft power. And whatever Joseph Nye intended when he first articulated the idea of soft power, it has come to be seen as this optional extra, to be seen as how do you export or make known your virtues? And my argument is that the reality of reputation has always been that it is a mixture, that it is both about telling people about your virtues, but it also has to be about addressing your deficiencies, your vices, minimizing these or even eliminating them. And this is, as the more I thought about this, I remembered something I'd been told by one of the main American public diplomats commissioned to work during the Vietnam War, amazing Armenian-American guy called Barry Zorthian. And he used to do this thing with journalists where they'd ask him, you know, what doctrine of foreign affairs did he use? And, you know, they'd sort of throw a couple of, do you believe in the Rostow Doctrine and or Truman Doctrine? And he'd say, no, I'm a believer in the Mercer Doctrine. And they'd say, Mercer? Which Mercer? And he would answer, Johnny Mercer. I think the United States needs to accentuate the positive, latch onto the affirmative, and eliminate the negative, right? Like the old song. He didn't mean conceal the negative. He meant actually eliminate the negative. So work out what is undercutting your case internationally and literally remove that. And you might say that that never happens in foreign affairs, but I've been able to find examples where it does, as you remember from the book.
And I know that in this case of Ukraine, this is actually, you know, one of the challenges, I think, because Ukraine, ultimately, the pride Ukrainians have taken with identity, with the establishment of the independent state. But of course, the Russians have been fairly adept over the years of pointing out the linkages between Ukrainian independence, Ukrainian identity, and connections with fascism. This is the references to that the Vladimir Putin makes about denazification in Ukraine. So ultimately, am I correct? I mean, that's an application of what you're describing in reputational security, in that Ukrainians need to advocate for all the wonderful things that Ukrainians have done, but also need to address the fact that there's a bit of a dark side to Ukraine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is dangerous to deny that dark side, because then you have blown up a kind of a reputational bubble, and all your adversary needs to do is put one hole in it and the whole thing will come down. You have to be honest and say there's good and bad in every country. And sometimes, you know, my enemy's enemy is not somebody I want to be identified with. And I think that you can see how Zelensky has had this very much in mind. Also, you can see how he has sought to address the narratives of corruption within Ukraine and firing people on his own team for corruption is part of eliminating the negative part and trying to be actually better. And I think part of the reason that the position of Ukraine improved between 2014 and 2022 was because of the efforts to rein in corruption. And you can see how, in fact, the metric I used to measure Ukraine's reputational change from 14 to 22 was the perception of the International Corruption Index, that it had changed from one position to another, where it's much enhanced in 2022.
And I noticed a number of your cases, and even the ones that you emphasized at the beginning of our conversation, we have a number of new countries. You mentioned about Kosovo, the former Soviet republics, and in particular, I've had this conversation with you before, so I thought it was wonderful to find it in the book, is this narrative of Kazakhstan. Yes. Kazakhstan, you know, a country that almost no one knew about. So you'd have to take an international relations course to even probably have heard of it. Then it becomes famous thanks to the comedian Sacha Baron Cohen and the Barat narrative. And for years, the description was always, this is terrible for Kazakhstan. They allowed Kazakhstan to be defined by Sacha Baron Cohen. But you actually, in the book, suggests that, that the Kazakh diplomats don't necessarily see it that way.
No, that's true. I met a very smart Kazakh diplomat who said that Sacha Baron Cohen was the best thing that happened to Kazakhstan in years, because he gave Kazakhstan something that regional equivalents like Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan don't have. If people know one thing about Kazakhstan, they can then build onto that one thing, even if that one thing is untrue. They can say, well, Kazakhstan is not like that, it is like this. And it's a tremendous gift. Not everybody was like that. I did meet one guy who apparently had got the job because his dad paid a bribe. And he said, if you ever met Sacha Baron Cohen, I would punch him. I would punch him for saying things about glorious nation of Kazakhstan. And I thought, well, it was sort of, basically, I found myself in the middle of a Borat sketch. And but, you know, the smart observers can see the value. And I think that reputational security or reputation diplomacy is one of the ways of understanding the Nazarbayev government's choices. If you remember, they wanted to build a role for Kazakhstan in religious reconciliation. So they began hosting world religious leaders for periodic conferences. And I think that's a very interesting choice to make. And there are other countries now that are similarly engaged in trying to build a reputation for the country around peacemaking.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're discussing a new book, Reputational Security, Refocusing Public Diplomacy for a Dangerous World. And we're interviewing the author, Nicholas Kull of the University of Southern California. In my opening, I said, you know, for international relations, particularly in the school of realism, there's this discourse about, is it power or is it security? And one of the things I found fascinating about your book is that usually when thinking of issues like public diplomacy, it gets cast as power, particularly, you know, this concept of soft power that you referenced with, you know, with the author Joseph Nye. But you've chosen in this analysis to focus on security. You know, sometimes we talk about the securitization of certain concepts that when it becomes about, you know, questions of security, first of all, it's part of a different discourse than just necessarily advancing power. But ultimately, the idea that your reputation needs to be protected and that your reputation is tied to your national security, I find fascinating. Why did you choose this framing of security as a, you know,
well, again,
as a foundational issue?
Really, yeah. Doug, it really comes from observation. I had long conversations with diplomats from Norway who explained that their country was endangered by Russian narratives about the Nordics, saying that they weren't virtuous, but they were predatory and corrupt, and they were adopting children so they could molest them and things like this. And they saw this as not just an inconvenience for Norway, but something that was a terrible risk to the country. And I think part of the problem with soft power is, and I heard this from senior American officials who tried to get funding for public diplomacy when they went up to Capitol Hill and said, we want funding to increase or to work with soft power, they found legislators were unconvinced because they didn't really want to be seen to be doing something soft. They identified soft with weak, soft with ineffective, or a kind of a luxury. They had more luck, the officials had more luck when they described what they were doing as smart power. But I think that the urgency of our moment required a different framing. And to me, thinking about this as a form of security relocates public diplomacy on the agenda from being this little extra thing to help diplomacy along after you've already decided to where I believe it ought to be, which is as a core activity and one on which success and on the international stage depends. And I also think that neglecting public diplomacy is much more than just skimping on a luxury. It's actually causes tremendous damage to the a country's foreign policy. And to me, that falls under insecurity. And I think it's, I'm appalled by the way in which US governments neglect public diplomacy. It doesn't matter which party's in power, when the senior job in public diplomacy is empty 40% of the time, at least, somebody's taking their eye off the ball routinely. And I have a problem with that. So reputational security there's rhetoric in the language. And the idea is take this seriously. It can help, but it can also hurt. And neglecting it is serious. And I found that this lines up very well with points that have been made by people like Robert Gates, for example, and his endorsement of the importance of public diplomacy. He's not talking about just putting out more flags, having more tours by jazz bands. He's talking about something, you know, very profound about protecting and projecting the country.
Now, it's tempting to take this conversation and think of this as kind of debates and discourses about certain policies. I know public diplomacy became very, very popular right after 9/11, and the notion that the U.S. needs to sell to the Arab street American military operations. But what you're describing here, particularly in reputational security, really tends to run a bit deeper. I know you make reference in the book to nation branding and this notion that it's not just about winning an argument, because a reputation is not about winning an argument. It's really about how others see you and the way in which, even when you start to make the argument, that argument's framed behind a reputation. So how different is this than just we need to be better at arguing our case?
Yeah, you see, I think this isn't about argument. It's about reality. And the best image in the world comes from the best reality in the world. And at key points in US history, American presidents have understood this. To me, it's really important that when the Soviet Union pointed out American racism in the 1950s and built a lot of their anti-American propaganda around the reality of Jim Crow and the reality of second-class citizens in the United States based on their race, President Eisenhower and then President Kennedy did not just say, oh, look, here's Sidney Poitier in a movie, or here's this lawyer who has qualified despite being African-American. They sought to actually make it better, to genuinely eliminate the negative, right? Similarly, 10 years later, from Eisenhower, when it's pointed out to President Johnson that the American immigration system is racist against people from East Asia, he doesn't just say, oh, no, it's not. He changes the system and says, look, this is untenable. He changes the reality. Flash forward another 10 years, Jimmy Carter, when it's pointed out that the United States is hypocritical around human rights, he actually tries to be more consistent in human rights policy. So this is important. And there are other countries too, where reform has been based on concern for international image. The problem, though, with doing a reform, an overdue reform, because you're concerned about your international image, is that sometimes you don't get the necessary follow through on the reform. They will do enough reform to change the international image, but not enough reform to actually make underlying conditions better. So you can see how civil rights reform moved in the right direction and then stopped, which is part of the problem we live with today. Similarly, I found that in Republican China, the awareness of international opinion was the big driver of the movement against foot binding, the beginning of this century. The discourse has virtually no mention of rights of Chinese women. It's all expressed in terms of what will foreigners think about China if they see this practice going on. So, you know, you can maybe start the ball rolling with the concern for international opinion, but it's necessary to keep it rolling if you want your reputation long-term by addressing underlying and associated concerns. So in the case of China, femicide would be an obvious next step. Right.
Yeah, and you're actually reminding me of how the State Department was one of the staunchest supporters of civil rights, in particular in the 1960s, because, I mean, so many diplomats said, we're going to post-colonial settings and talking about democracy and trying to attract new post-colonial states. And they're pointing out, well, yes, but Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. And to bring this, you know, to the very, very present, the U.S., I imagine American diplomats are having some significant problems with advancing women's rights post-Dobbs, mm-hmm. and the way in which a number of states, in some cases, France preparing to pass legislation on legalizing abortion, you know, expressly seems to be directed at, you know, at the United States. So these would be examples of sort of challenges to reputational security. Yes.
I think that's okay. Correct. The one that I'm hearing from American diplomats right now, however, is international concern over gun control. And that's actually getting in the way of American public diplomacy, not just because it gives the US a bad reputation, but also the great strength in American public diplomacy has always been, hey, why don't you come and see for yourself? And now American diplomats are routinely being told, we don't want to come and see for ourselves because, you know, there's school shootings and it's too dangerous. And even people who are in war zones are saying, I'd like to play it safe and stay home rather than chance a scholarship to a school in Texas.
The book is called Reputational Security: Refocusing Public Diplomacy for a Dangerous World. The author is Nicholas Kahl. He's professor of communication at the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California. We're going to take a break. And when we return, Nick is going to be joined by a couple of other scholars in public diplomacy. And we'll expand the conversation to try to explore what reputational security means broadly for public diplomacy and to get some reactions to the book as well.
When we come back, how does protecting reputations fit within states' public diplomacy efforts? Stay with us.
Everything in life is a negotiation.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How has social media and other communication technologies affected states and their efforts to protect their reputations? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. In our first segment, we interviewed Nick Kahl, who's written a new book called Reputational Security: Refocusing Public Diplomacy for a Dangerous World. So in this segment, We've invited a couple of other public diplomacy scholars to join Nick and talk about the concept of reputational security, how it relates to questions about soft power, questions about communication of reputation, and broadly about public diplomacy. So Nick Cull rejoins us. He is the professor of communication at the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California. He is joined by Rhonda Zaharna. She's full professor in the School of Communication at American University. She's the author of Battles to Bridges, U.S. Strategic Communication and Public Diplomacy After 9/11, and Boundary Spanners of Humanity, Three Logics of Communication and Public Diplomacy. And Ilan Manner, he is digital diplomacy scholar and lecturer at Tel Aviv University and Ben-Gurion University of Negev. He is the author of The Digitalization of Public Diplomacy and Public Diplomacy and the Politics of Uncertainty. Thank you all very much for joining us. And Rhonda Zaharna, I'll start with you. Nick Cull's introduced this concept of reputational security in the context of public diplomacy. What is your understanding of what reputational security might mean and how that fits, you know, broadly within public diplomacy?
Thank you, Doug. I believe it's pathbreaking. And one of the reasons why is I think it introduces the all-important emotional and relational dimension, which I think has been missing from IR and public diplomacy. IR is very state-based, individual-based. You have individual agency, images, goals. You have this rational actor and soft power. So it's all a very individual perspective. And I think what's so valuable about or pathbreaking about reputational security is we now have this relational dimension. It's the ISA, the International Studies Association, the theme this year is relationality. It's we're no longer looking at things on the individual level, the abstract level. We're talking about a relational. And so that we've got the global community, we've got the social dimension, social media, social networks that we're realizing states are social actors. They're relational actors. We're moving from rational actors to relational actors. And I think this perspective is what makes it valuable.
Oh, absolutely. And Ilan Manner, I'd love to get your initial reactions, this concept of reputational security within public diplomacy and international relations.
First of all, thanks for the invitation to join such a distinguished panel of speakers. Delighted to be here with you and Rhonda and Nick. I think that in part, what we see here is a very timely reflection on public diplomacy and on the concept of soft power. And for many years, public diplomacy and IR scholars use this conceptual prism of soft power as a way of making sense of the world and how states present themselves on the world stage. But we had all of these terms that we kind of forgot about, such as reputation and image and prestige, and also power. Soft power, as much as it filled the void, it also created a void, because soft power almost turned power into something that was palatable, because suddenly it was soft and it was nice. And I think that the world has dramatically changed since this concept of soft power was introduced and public diplomacy went through its main change following 9/11. And the world has changed in the sense that we're seeing more conflict, we're seeing a new balance of power in the world, and we are seeing the huge effect of digital communications. And all of these actually make it incumbent upon us to rethink how this idea of a national image or a national reputation actually works and how it can be used strategically to benefit a state or a region. And that is where I think Nick really offers a very, very timely reflection and also brings back this aspect of power into the discussion of public diplomacy.
Now, Ilan, I want to follow up. I know you write quite a bit on social media, digitization, et cetera. And in the conversation I had with Nick before, and I'll let him respond after this, we talked a lot about how states, the whole notion of reputational security is the states needing to defend themselves against potential attacks, defend themselves against criticisms, et cetera. Social media is really decentralized that, hasn't it? I mean, the nature of the critiques themselves coming from all these different sources, this is not really state to state. I'm not sure it always was anyway, but social media's really opened that up, hasn't it?
Well, I think this really ties back to what Rhonda was talking about, the rise of relationships in all directions. You know, I've been studying social media and public diplomacy for 15 years, and I've come to the conclusion that any generalization then defies the generalization. So it's very hard to say anything concrete about social media, because it's a new tool for states to project themselves. It's a new tool for people within a state to partake in national image projection. But it's also a very powerful tool for harming a nation's image or defaming a nation's image, and especially through the use of lies, manipulation, and disinformation. I think it would be also fascinating to hear from Nick what he thinks is going to be in the next stage beyond social media, what we're seeing now of the rise of AI, ChatGPT, and these kinds of tools that are going to be huge threats to nations, but also, looking at Rhonda's perspective, threats to communities, threats to humanity, because of the ability to disseminate information that leads states to raise arms against one another, which is a very disconcerting trend that we're seeing right now around the world.
Yeah, Nick, that was going to be my next question is, the digitization and this, all these new tools make it so much more of a challenge to defend your reputation. How have states tried to do that?
First thing to say is that there's a chapter in the book that looks at the reasons why we're in the mess we are in and why reputation is so important. And part of that, I believe, is to do with the disruption and confusion that always comes whenever there is a new platform of communication in the political sphere. And I found that looking back historically, we underestimate the extent to which the worst things that have happened in diplomacy have been tied or have coincided with moments both of economic disruption, this we know, but moments of media disruption. And the media disruption part is forgotten about. So no one calls World War I the war the popular press made. No one calls World War II the war the newsreels and radio propaganda made. Even though you can't understand the mindset that created these conflicts without understanding that new media was on the scene and publics were unable to pass that media. They were unable to inoculate themselves against being manipulated by that media. Coming out of those two conflicts, World War I and World War II, both had were associated with a mature attitude to media, a harnessing of media, media, what I would call now media disarmament. So what worries me about the situation, and I apply the same arguments to the Cold War too, what worries me about the situation now is that the turnover of media coming into existence is so fast that we are barely used to one thing, and then another thing comes along. So we were barely used to the internet when social media came along. And now we're barely used to social media and how to read a tweet and or an X or whatever you're going to call it, understand a TikTok. And then along comes AI. And so I think this is like trying to stand up in the ocean when the waves are coming faster and faster. It's a very worrying situation. My solutions, because the book does have some solutions, are that we have to understand the problem. We need to negotiate about the problem. One of the fallacies in public diplomacy is that a communication problem has a communication solution. Maybe this has a diplomatic solution. And we need to say to our adversaries, it's not in your interest to undercut public life. I'm sure the Russians would not respond to that, but I think the Chinese would. Mm-hmm. And that we need to have what I call information disarmament. The other thing is that the problem with nation branding, the problem with soft power, the problem with so much public diplomacy is it was seen as a zero-sum game. This country has to have a good image. Therefore, when Germany's image increases, France's image diminishes, or Italy's image diminishes, carrying on like it was 1899. That's not the way the world is now. We have a vested interest in the success of the images of other democracies. Therefore, we should conceptualize what I call collective reputational security and help one another to overcome the challenges. And this was done really effectively in the struggle against ISIS, working with partners who were credible to the people who were most prone to ISIS propaganda, people in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. But I think that today we need to look at how we maintain the reputational security of democracy as a whole. And some of that means saying to our friends, a friend can say this, but you need to clean up your act. You know, yeah. If you want a reputation for being a good functioning democracy, how about functioning like a democracy? Hmm. Right. So tough talk, I think, is part of collective reputational security. Yeah, anyway, but I think these are great questions. But I mean, I wonder what Rhonda makes of it.
No, Rhonda, I wanted to get your thoughts on this as well.
I want to say about the media, and I was going to ask Ilan about this, because when I was studying social media, the one thing that jumped out at me, and I wrote about this, was about the emotional dimension of social media. It's a handheld. It's always on. It's there. It's that. And then when I was listening to you and you were talking about these media disruptions, radio is the voice. It's how much emotion is conveyed through the voice. 38%, they say. And so this was like the first time people, it's not that interpersonal, direct, embodied communication. Here you've got from the airwaves emotion. It's charged. Then you have TV. It's not just like me sitting there with you. The TV is in a very intimate space. It's a distance you can reach out. And so you've got, the visual, and it's focused on the face, which is amazing. So we've got, and when I was thinking, when you said AI, that's the one thing they're having a hard time duplicating, is that emotion. It does, it's, and that, Ilan, I guess that's what I want to bring out. It's people trying to catch up with this emotional dimension of media, which takes the content to another level. It's not just what's said, it's the emotional resonance within it. And I think that's maybe what gives it some power there. So that's just what I wanted to put in about the reputational. It's not just a social, there's an emotional, it's a heuristic.
Absolutely. Ilan, I'll then turn to you and get your reaction to that, the emotions of and what makes social media pretty intimate and emotional in that way.
So it's very interesting that Nick brought up the phenomenon that we're witnessing of digital acceleration and technological acceleration and the speed with which new technologies are being rolled out. I mean, only 3 weeks ago, we discovered that the company that launched ChatGPT can now turn text into videos within 30 seconds. And if you've seen these AI videos, they're all focusing on what Rhonda talked about. They're all very emotional videos. It's videos of puppies. It's videos of a couple meeting. It's videos of walking and kind of seeing a bazaar or going through a market and experiencing everything that a new country has to offer. So I think what we're going to see with visual AI is this mix of very powerful information manipulation and content that has an emotional resonance, specifically because it's visual, because it's based in visual, and almost any visual that can be generated. Another thing that I find very, very alarming in the context of the war in Ukraine is that this, I think, is the first drone war, in the sense that a lot of the coverage that we're seeing, war coverage from Ukraine, actually disseminates from drones. Now, drones don't have that emotional barrier. Drones linger in air and on air. And so a lot of the videos coming out of Ukraine and that are actually used by the state of Ukraine or by the Ukrainian forces are of drones that fly over a target, attack the target, and they stay in the air. And they picture also what happens once the target has been struck and once people are killed or maimed. And then this entire video is uploaded on social media, and it's very disturbing. If a human journalist were there at some point, he would look away because he's a human being. And this mediation of war through drones lacks that emotional component and is very, very dangerous, I think. And more content that I see on social media originates from drones. On the other hand, it's, and this might connect to what Nick was saying, it is verified information in the sense that it really happened. A drone recorded it. We're not just telling you that we attacked a Russian outpost or that we attacked a Russian tank. We are showing you the tank that was blown up. So it lends to credibility, and credibility is very important to a country's reputation. So I wonder what Nick would make of all of this mess.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're discussing Nick Kahl's new book, Reputational Security, Refocusing Public Diplomacy for a Dangerous World, with Nick Kahl of the University of Southern California, Rhonda Zaharna of American University, and Ilan Manner of Tel Aviv University and Ben-Gurion University of Negev. And Ilan, you know, asked the question of you, Nick, and I'm going to ask you to respond to a couple of key questions. The role that emotion plays, you know, with respect to reputation, and also, I think these are linked, the role that the way reputation is not just something that sort of exists and based on interests, but really tends to be much more relational.
Absolutely. I see reputation as being an emotional response that's built up over a long period of time. And I think it's something to be protected. I think that one of the implications of reframing public diplomacy in terms of reputational security is that it puts a much more of an emphasis on the cultural, on cultural diplomacy. I would draw a parallel here to the kind of training that a diplomat is given what to do in the event of being taken hostage. And a diplomat is told, try to establish a rapport with your hostage takers. Try to explain that you're a person like them. Talk about your family, talk about your interests. And the most basic form of reputational security in cultural diplomacy is to do the same, to say, I'm from a country like your country, and this is what we do, this is how we think, to promote empathy. Because if we're in a world where it's possible for us to empathize with one another, international relations will go better. And so many of the problems that we encounter are based on not granting full personhood to the people with whom we interact. And maybe that is a necessary condition of the brutality required for a physical victory. But I think the world will be a better place if we realize that we're dealing with people like ourselves. So we can use cultural diplomacy as a mechanism for building empathy, if you like, and to engineer empathy. The other thing that I think comes out of this is we have to pay more attention to the diaspora experience. So there's a whole chapter in the book on diasporas, because we may think of international relations as being built out of nation states, but there are so many diasporans now crossing the world, informing and creating new kinds of international relations from the bottom up, that if our ideas about international relations don't include those people, then the system is going to fall apart. And our mechanisms for describing the world will be inadequate.
No, absolutely. Actually, you're describing something in international relations about almost like de-sovereignizing these descriptions. Yes. Because the diasporas frequently are seen as, you know, how do they support the state as opposed to being a big broader, you know, part of that community. You know,
yeah, and in fact, Doug, just to jump back on that, I'd say, yeah, maybe they don't fit with the state, but they certainly fit with the city. And so this is another aspect of where this all seems to be going, is towards cities being a better way of thinking about how we live and how we interact in the world than these rusty old nation states.
No, absolutely. And Rhonda, you had a response as well.
Yes. You know, Nick, I was actually going to push back on the thing about culture. And, you know, I'm big on culture. One thing about reputational security is it's not just about the good. It's like you said, it's taking care of those that would detract. And humans are very good at focusing on the negative. If there's a hair standing out, they'll catch that.
Yeah.
And I want to say the thing about reputational security, More than culture, I think it's going to foreground policy. It's kind of like corporate social responsibility. It used to be that profits were the bottom line. Now companies, you do well by doing good.
Absolutely. I agree with you completely. And one of the things that we're seeing is that sometimes for policy reasons, you have to change your culture. So in the first segment, I talked about how for policy reasons, China had to get rid of foot binding for women. For policy reasons right now, the South Korean government is getting rid of the eating of dog meat because this is clearly an international outlier and it's something they have to get rid of. So all culture isn't created equal. You can't just say, you know, it's my culture if that is at odds with international standards. And sometimes people try and bond with an element of their culture, which is repellent to an international audience or at odds with an international audience or international standards. So absolutely, policy is part of this. And what fascinates me as I'm continuing with the research, now the book's out, I've been pushing it further and further back in history. And I find how culture is sometimes the problem for reputational security. So the British decision to interrupt Hindu funeral rites in India that involved self-immolation of widows, was based on that damaging the reputation of Britain. The person who passed the laws against it wrote about the Dutch don't do it. The Danish think it's a bad thing that the British do it. We have to stop this practice, even though it's part of culture. So I think reputational security is a way of looking at and understanding some of the policy discussions around culture. And that goes exactly to what you're saying. So that was a good, helpful intervention, Rhonda.
And Rhonda, do you have a response to that as well?
No, I want to leave time for Manor.
Okay.
It's been a couple of minutes. We haven't heard.
And this big, you know, broader question that we talked about a bit more in the first segment that I want to make sure to bring in here is how much is reputational security about having an argument, a discourse to try to counter criticisms versus actually changing policy? Yeah, and that's something that obviously Nick has highlighted here. Yeah. So Elon, I'd love to get your thoughts on, you know, on that question as well, that reputation is less about how you present yourself and more about how you are.
So, yeah, I mean, definitely a country with terrible policies is not going to be able to market itself as a wonderful tourist destination. A country torn by civil war is not going to be able to have an attractive brand. I think that what Nick touches on also here is that reputational security might not necessarily stem from the state, but from credible spokespeople who represent the state. And one of the interesting examples we see of this again in Ukraine is that the Ukrainian government realized that at some point it needed to retain support in America for the war effort, but perhaps people in America were not viewing Ukraine as a credible spokesperson because it's got chips in the game. So they've actually appointed a set of digital ambassadors who speak on behalf of Ukraine. And these are people who are credible amongst their online followers. They're credible amongst their online communities. And it's a very, you know, it's a very interesting gallery of people, from Mark Hamill, who plays Luke Skywalker, to a NASA astronaut, to an academic, to Barbara Streisand. So who doesn't like Barbara? But it's a broad category of people, of ambassadors who speak on behalf of Ukraine, and they are each credible amongst their community, but not necessarily amongst each other's community. And we forget a lot of time that we do not want to hear from states. We don't necessarily believe states. There is a crisis of legitimacy for governments all over the world, both within their country and without their country. And what Nick touched on earlier, and I think this is also very important for the relational component, is it's not just about being credible, it's about having credible spokespeople. That includes your diplomats, but it also includes other people who can communicate what you're trying to say to a specific audience much more better than you could have ever done.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. In fact, I now routinely tell diplomats that the nature of public diplomacy has changed. It is no longer, as it was in the Cold War and immediate Cold War period, about what can I say to persuade you. It's now about who can I empower to persuade you. And that empowerment is often about somebody who is similar, somebody who has a perceived connection, who has credibility for the audience you want to reach. And you can guarantee that person won't be a government minister, probably won't hold a diplomatic credential. And the problem is that other people can empower people who are credible to be disruptive and to detract from your reputation. So, we face this as a negative. I think, essentially in a world war of reputation, or a world war of information that is undeclared, and nobody is, we're not responding with an appropriate level of seriousness to the scale of the scale of the threat and the stakes that are raised in this kind of international situation.
So, Rhonda, one last topic I definitely want to delve into here is Nick's framing of reputation as a security question, because in particular, in contrast to the idea of smart powers being the, you know, this question about the advancement of power, security within international relations has a very specific context. And so ultimately, is the protection of your reputation, is it best viewed as a security question, the need to protect, in the same context of just a way to advance power or a way to, you know, blunt criticism?
You know what? I'm a communication scholar more than an IR scholar. And so for more than security, I want to pass that on, because I mean, I see it as a relational imperative. Those that are isolated are vulnerable, and societies and countries that are isolated are vulnerable. And so I see it as that. It's more of, and one of the things that I was with Nick, and we were in a conference, and he said that reputational security was important to the Vikings, as important to the Vikings as it is to any country now. And I really pondered on that. Why is that? And that's because states, I would say, are relational entities, and we're in an international community. And so we're moving away from these little isolated blocks where we're in a relational setting. So it is an imperative. It's a security imperative. If we all just had these little blocks and our borders were all secure, then it would be all fine. But when they're now more nebulous, it becomes more of an imperative to have that.
Now, Nick, I'm going to give you the last word. Ultimately, what do you see as the most important takeaway from your book?
Buy the book and read it. I think what I want people to get out of the book is that reputation matters. And what works between individuals and what works is more similar to what works between nation states than it is different. And I want people to be able to apply things like empathy to international relations and to see how the human is the building block of international relations. And that's really what I'm getting at. And in policy terms, the best policies in the world can't be, the worst policies in the world can't be solved by the best public diplomacy. Sometimes you have to change your policies. And this has always been off the table in recent public diplomacy. I think that the public relations framework as understood in Washington, oh, let's call in an expert and make something look great when it isn't, that is untenable. That's untenable. And the sooner we move beyond that and start not just talking a better game, but actually being better, to me, that's the implication of the most important implication of this reputational security concept.
No, absolutely. I think one of my main takeaways after reading the book is, of course, reputation matters a great deal. It is a fundamental aspect of national interests, of national security. But ultimately, if you want to have a good reputation, you need to have earned it. And so ultimately, so much about reputation is actually a judgment on the basis of your policies. The book is called Reputational Security: Refocusing Public Diplomacy for a Dangerous World. We've been discussing this with our panel, Nick Kull. He's the author of the book. He's also professor of communication at the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California. Other publications of his are The Decline and Fall of the United States Information Agency, American Public Diplomacy from 1989 to 2001, and Public Diplomacy, Foundations for Global Engagement in the Digital Age. Rhonda Zaharna, she's full professor in the School of Communications at American University. She's the author of Battles to Bridges, U.S. Strategic Communication and Public Diplomacy After 9/11, and Boundary Spanners of Humanity, Three Logics of Communication and Public Diplomacy. And Ilan Manner is digital diplomacy scholar and lecturer at Tel Aviv University and Ben-Gurion University of Negev. He's the author of The Digitalization of Public Diplomacy and Public Diplomacy and the Politics of Uncertainty. Thank you all very, very much for joining us and for sharing your time and your expertise.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Mehike Chechi is our assistant producer. Seth Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.